This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Annabelle Quince here, welcoming you to Rear Vision, the Radio National program that has taken up the Prime Minister's ideas on history and put chronology and dates back into the history behind current events. In today's program, we're taking a look at a small mountainous part of the world where for almost 60 years the monarchy has been locked in battle, first with the forces of democracy and later with the Maoists. I am, of course, talking about the Himalayan Kingdom of Nepal. Strategically placed between two giants, China and India, Nepal was a country that barely registered with the world, except as part of the hippie trail or as a great place to go hiking.
Stunned silence is rapidly turning to anger and frustration as the people of Nepal want to know why their beloved king and his family were gunned down.
The Himalayan Kingdom of Nepal is in mourning for its slain king and queen. But amid the grief, there's mounting intrigue about the circumstances surrounding the...
That all changed in 2002, when the Nepalese crown prince, high on drugs and emotionally unstable, shot dead the king, queen and seven members of the royal family before turning the gun on himself. Then we became aware of the Nepalese Maoists waging a violent insurgency across the countryside, disrupting elections and kidnapping officials. And in February last year, the current king, Gyanendra, seized power and imposed rule from the palace.
Violence and boycotts have marked the lead-up to today's local elections in the troubled Hindu kingdom of Nepal.
Last Wednesday, the government of King Gyanendra held local elections, the first elections in Nepal for 7 years, and billed them as a step back to democracy. But the poll was marred by violence and low voter turnout.
At least 8 people have been killed in clashes with security forces and a strike has paralysed the nation. The government has also imprisoned hundreds of opposition members who've urged a boycott of the vote.
How and why, in just a few short years, has the democratic nation of Nepal been thrown into chaos? Like all stories that suddenly hit the headlines, the real story begins much further back. In the period before 1951, when the idea of democracy first arrived in Nepal from India. Deepak Thapa is a writer, journalist and expert on the Maoist movement of Nepal.
One has to understand that Nepal entered the 20th century only in 1951. Until 1951, Nepal had been isolated from the rest of the world. Nepalese were allowed to go outside, but there was no outside influence allowed into the country. But then basically, we were an isolated country. And we were even more isolated than Tibet was at that time. In fact, like Tibet had much more commerce going on and comings and going on between British India and Tibet. To give an example of how isolated we were, early expeditions to Mount Everest took place from the northern side, from the Tibetan side, because Nepal would not allow access to Mount Everest from the southern side. So when 1951 happened, and then we had these political changes, which had been imported basically, you know, via India, Western ideas of a representative government, the Nepalese themselves were not really well educated on the intricacies of how such a polity functioned. We were very undeveloped. We had just one college in the whole country, a handful of schools. Anyone who wanted to become educated had to go to India for further education. There was nothing. We didn't even have a single road linking any part with another part. You know, we had a few dozen kilometers of road within the capital city, but there was no road that linked the capital to any other part of Nepal. So that basically sums up what Nepal was like in the 1950s and, you know, the early part of the 60s.
Nepal as a nation came together at the end of the 18th century. Its borders were defined by the expanding British East India Company in the south and the Chinese Qing dynasty to the north. The dominant political force through the 19th century was one family, the Rana family. What distinguished their rule, apart from their close connection to the British Empire, was their unique political structure. While there was a king who remained the head of state, the real power in Nepal lay with the Ranas, and in particular, the Rana Prime Minister. John Welpton, writer-historian and author of A History of Nepal.
Now, what happened in 1846 when the Ranas started was, in the first place, simply that the focus of the structure at the centre slightly shifted, so that the royal family, the king, became a bit like the Japanese emperor under the shogunate, Japan before 1867, so that you kept the king as a kind of religious symbol and a symbol of legitimacy, but the actual head of the administration was the Rana Prime Minister Maharaja.
What effect did that have on everyday lives of people in Nepal?
Most people, as they still do today, were living in villages, and you, on your day-to-day life, you would not be engaged with the state in the way that you are in a modern Western country. So the state was relatively remote, but there would be a local overlord of some type, whether a sort of headman from your ethnic group or someone who'd been granted the revenue rights to the land in your area. And the state was mainly collecting revenue, providing some judicial services.
And the Ranas had a very close connection with the British, didn't they?
That's right. As you go later on, you get into the 20th century, the situation in South Asia shifted in that, whereas before the British had tended to want to supplant, you know, native rulers and bring in their own direct administration, after the Indian Mutiny, they felt a bit less secure, and they began to see traditional rulers, the Maharajas, as potential allies against Indians who had been educated on more Western lines and who were beginning to demand political institutions involving some form of democracy. The Ranas were very much against, most of the time, any kind of political reform. And this actually suited the British because it meant that there was less likely to be the kind of agitation within Nepal that was beginning to take place in India.
There had been a small movement for democracy in Nepal since the end of World War I, but the real push came after World War II in 1947 when India gained its independence.
The anti-colonial movement in South Asia, especially in what was then India, influenced the Nepalese, the educated Nepalese, a great deal. That's because our primary socialization politically and culturally also has been through India. So it was not a surprise that the stirrings of the anti-Rana regime movement would begin from India, among the Nepalese, among the exiled Nepalese, among the migrant Nepali communities, or what you might call an expat Nepali community in India. That's where it started.
The complication was it wasn't just a matter of sort of modernizing reformers versus the traditional regime. The royal family, particularly King Tribhuvan, the grandfather of the present king, was unhappy with his position as a kind of cipher with all the real power in Rana hands. So he got in touch with some of the people in the opposition, so that when the Rana regime was actually forced to yield power in 1950-51, it was really a three-way combination of the Nepalese, more sort of radical groups, the Nepalese royal family, and India giving some support.
The movement for democracy in Nepal coincided with the annexation of Tibet by China in 1950. India, fearing an expanding China, backed the democratic movement over the Rana family, and in particular the Nepalese Congress Party, which had close links to the Indian Congress Party.
So we had this a successful movement against the autocratic Rana regime. But what happened was the people who led the movement were all very young. They were in their 30s with no experience whatsoever in government. So we saw a plethora of political parties, which were basically personality-based parties, which all staked a claim to be the most representative of the parties in Nepal. And that led to a situation for about 8 years of great instability, where you saw one party after the other stake a claim to form the government. And the king willy-nilly was forced to go along with the political situation at that time. And, you know, the political parties wanted a test of electoral strength. You know, the king was playing his own games also. The king at that time is the present king's father. So they did not want to actually test the political parties in the electoral field. But finally, in 1959, we did have an election, a general election, the first time ever in the history of Nepal. And the main party, which is also the largest party at the moment, the Nepali Congress, gained a 2/3 majority and formed the government. but the prime minister who was elected was not able to work together with the king, or the king was not able to work together with the prime minister. So within 18 months, they had a falling out. Both were very strong personalities, and there did not seem to be enough space for two very strong personalities at the center of Nepali politics. So the king dissolved the parliament, he arrested the prime minister and banned all the political parties.
Roderick Chama from the International Crisis Group points out that the method used by King Mahendra in 1960 to seize power are almost identical to those used by his son, the current king, last year.
How he actually did it was perfectly simple. He simply arrested all of the democratic politicians and locked them up until some of them came around to supporting him and others went into exile, went underground or were kept in prison for long periods of time. He had with him, as the current king does, the army. And that was the crucial force factor that allowed him to impose his will on the others. What's interesting is that in many ways, King Gyanendra has envisaged his current effort to reassert the palace's power in very similar terms. Back in 1960, King Mahendra knew that what he did would not go down well with India, but he was also confident that he could tough it out and that within a few months or so, India would have to accept the new reality and would slowly come round to supporting him. And this, of course, was in the context of a much more intense Cold War era rivalry between India and China, which, of course, then was a genuinely Maoist country under the leadership of Mao and an intense rival of India's. And Mahendra, I think, probably made the correct calculation then that India did swallow its concerns about democracy, about the nature of the government of the country, and was more concerned that China shouldn't be allowed to extend its influence too far into the country.
Mahendra established a system of government known as a partyless democracy.
Well, I think one thing to remember is that the decolonization era was one in which there were a number of experiments in various forms of qualified democracy carried out around the world. And King Mahendra's form of partyless democracy was precisely that. It was a facade applied to a country that was actually run very effectively directly from the palace. So there were elections to local positions and then from local positions to national bodies. But as no one was allowed to organise in political parties, there was no way for people to actually challenge the fundamental power of the palace to have to hold sway, have its own policies implemented.
This system of a partyless democracy survived in Nepal for almost 30 years. But at the same time, a movement for democracy continued to exist both inside and outside Nepal.
There had, in fact, been a continuation of the democratic movement throughout the intervening years. By the time you got to the 1980s, a few things had changed. Yes, it was the case that the domestic political forces had managed to get their act together a bit more and unite around a common platform for democracy. But also the world as a whole was changing. We were approaching the end of the Cold War era, and just before the momentous changes in Nepal in 1990, people there had been hearing about the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of other regimes. And so there was an extent to which the global environment was one which was favourable towards removing old autocratic systems of government and sweeping them aside in favour of a more democratic movement. It was also the fact that this suited India. And many of the most intense final protests were intensified by the fact that India carried out an effective economic blockade of the country, which pushed up the prices of basic commodities, increased unrest and dissatisfaction among the population at large. So there were a number of external factors as well as the internal desire for democracy, which was clearly demonstrated by the vast majority of people.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the history of Nepal. King Mahendra, who had seized power in 1960, died in 1972, and his eldest son, Birendra, came to the throne. A very different character from his father, Birendra was prepared, when pushed, to accommodate democratic demands.
King Birendra, as one of the world's last absolute monarchs, has now bargained away his position as Nepal's autocratic ruler in the face of mounting pressure from an increasingly violent pro-democracy campaign. The movement reached a peak on Friday when 100,000 protesters marched on the royal palace, demanding that the king agree to holding free elections as soon as possible.
The first democratic elections in Nepal for 30 years were held in May 1991.
I think the indications are that the Nepali Congress Party will win, perhaps not in an outright sense, but will certainly have the major share of the seats. There will be strong opposition from the UML, the Marxist Party, the Nepalese Communist Party. The indications are that this country will have a functioning democracy in a matter of a few days.
Again, that we face the same problem that we faced in the early 50s. Because we suddenly saw a group of people come to power who had been in the political wilderness for the past 30 years. So they had absolutely no idea about how to run the country. We saw politicians who had absolutely no idea how a parliamentary democracy functioned. So in opposition to a party was taken as a personal affront. They saw no way of working together for the country. So it was quite a mess. And then, of course, compounding that was the infighting that was going on within the various political parties themselves. And that led to a great deal of instability. And in 1994, we had a midterm election, 3 years after the first parliament had been elected. And then the midterm election threw up a hung parliament where no one had a majority. So that led to a great deal of horse trading that went on for about 5 years where, all kinds of coalitions were formed in order to run the government.
Leftist parties dominated Nepalese politics, and one of the most extreme was the Communist Party of Nepal, known as the Maoists. In 1995, they put forward a list of 40 demands, including an elected constitutional assembly, to rewrite the constitution. In February 1996, believing that they were being ignored, they began a violent insurgency.
High in the remote hills of Nepal's Midwest, young Maoists dance and sing in costume, while their comrades look on, holding guns. Nepal's Maoist army is a young phenomenon in more ways than one. Most of its members are in their teens or 20s and are fighting for a cause just 7.5 years old. In that time, they have managed to gain control of one-third of Nepal. These homegrown Maoists are not supported by China, and started out demanding that Nepal's monarchy be overthrown in favour of a communist republic, as a means of giving Nepal's rural poor a real voice in the running of their country.
Initially, they gained a great deal of support from among the villagers in the rural areas, mainly because we have a country which emerged, like I said, out of isolation in the 1950s only. And then you had a series of governments that were, more interested, in the case of the royalist government for 30 years, more interested in its own benefit. And then the political parties, which ruled for about 12 years, which were also not very capable. So you had a rural population that had been sidelined from all kinds of development activity over the years. So when the Maoists came along with their, rhetoric of a golden future, it did invite some amount of attraction to the rural population. And when the fighting started, the government used very harsh methods to crack down on party activists or anyone that anyone said was a supporter of the Maoist party. So that led to a great abuse of human rights. And that had the direct effect that more and more people began supporting the Maoists, who also had initiated some social reform activities at that time, such as outlawed untouchability. So these were activities that attracted a lot of people in the initial days.
So they actually have a big social role as well, because the thing we tend to hear in the West is that they are terrorists, they're Maoist terrorists, and I guess that's the way they're perceived by the United States.
I think they're a bit more complex than that. They use terrorist methods, as do many political groups in the world. But many of us would shirk from calling them terrorists, in the sense that you get when you hear of Al-Qaeda or some groups like that. And this is a political organization that uses terrorist methods. There's no doubt about the methods they use. They use terror. But then, of course, they're more complex than that. They are a political party also. It is a political force.
While the government and the army were struggling to deal with the Maoist insurgency, another force was about to be unleashed in Nepal. In June 2001, the Crown Prince of Nepal shot dead his father, the king, his mother, and seven other members of the royal family.
Around about 9 o'clock, I heard a burst of gunfire around this area. And all of a sudden, I heard people say that the late Majesty King Birendra had been shot. What motivated him to do this, I'm not sure. But it was the then Crown Prince Dipendra who committed this murder. Anybody who touches the king is no more what he used to be. He was just a murderer.
We're still only seeing now, 4 or 5 years later, the ramifications of the impact of that event. My own feeling is that, in a way, it broke the long-established bond between the palace and the people. It signalled a rather dramatic change in the contract between the institution and the subjects of the country. And not just a shock as in a natural calamity, but a shock which led many people to develop various conspiracy theories and to suspect that there must have been foul play involved. So that meant that the new king, King Ganendra, came to the throne under a cloud of not only grief and trauma, but also various rather abstract and often rather vaguely expressed suspicions that there must be more to this than meets the eye.
And he's also a very different kind of character to his brother too, isn't he?
Yes, well, he himself chose to make it very clear from the outset in his public statements, in interviews he gave to the domestic and international media, that he was a different character and that he envisaged the role of the monarchy in Nepal very differently from the way his brother did. And when he came to the throne after the palace massacre in 2001, he said indeed that the king is not just there to be seen and not heard. If the country is in trouble, if other institutions are failing, then the king has not only a right, but a duty to speak out, to get involved, to take action.
On the 1st of February 2005, the king did take action. He seized power in a way reminiscent of his father in 1960, and for the past 12 months, he has effectively ruled Nepal from the palace.
He explained this in terms of the Democrats having failed, in terms of him needing to control corruption, to bring the Maoist insurgency to heel, and to reinvigorate democracy by doing so. But others have suspected that this was more about seizing the opportunity when mainstream parties were relatively discredited, when the Maoist threat provided an obvious scare for other countries to step in and offer a firm and authoritarian style of leadership that he hoped would appeal domestically and also be saleable on the international front.
What of the elections that were held last Wednesday? Were they, as the king claimed, a way back to democracy?
As far as the elections, the elections were a big farce. And as far as I'm concerned, the government of Nepal has been the laughingstock of the world. These were elections where there was no candidacy for half the positions available. Many of the people who actually stood up for elections were elected unopposed. These are not representative politicians.
So where does that leave democracy in Nepal?
The only thing that can force the king to act in a more democratic manner is a convergence of the international community on the need for the king and the parties and the Maoists to work together to end the violence and to initiate moves to begin the structural changes that the Maoists have demanded, that the political parties have mentioned in their electoral manifestos from 1990, and that the king has admitted himself were very genuine demands. So why can't they talk it out? Of course, like, we understand that the Maoists also want to come to power in some form or the other. But then I think taking a chance by talking to the Maoists and then legitimizing them somehow is a better way of ending this imbroglio than the continuous fighting, which has seen so many people killed and so many more displaced.
Deepak Thapa, Nepalese writer, journalist and expert on the Maoists. And clearly this is a story that has many more chapters to be written. Tune in next week as Kerry Phillips explores the history and politicisation of the hijab. Thanks to Angus Kingston for technical production and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.